I mean, it's like three legislators in the whole building.
Good afternoon, everyone. The Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue is open.
Yes, I probably am.
We're going to move into a work session for purposes of introducing some committee bills. So we are in work session. We have three committee bills for the February session. Dr. Warner, can you give us a brief summary of each concept?
Okay, will do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back, everybody. The three LCs conveniently are consecutively numbered. 177 is an SJR. This is an overall property tax reform proposal that you have discussed during the session, during the regular session. And what it does is, this is the outline for that structure you've been working with. It essentially moves, it eliminates the Measure 50 assessed value limits, retains the permanent rate limits to Measure 50, and moves toward a market value-based assessment. The market value assessment is general enough that you'd have flexibility legislatively on how you define that. It wouldn't have to be for a specific date, for example. Could be a moving average. The other key element to it directs the legislature to establish a homestead exemption by law, and the details would follow in another statutory measure. So that's LC 177. Mm-hmm. LC 178 corrects a technical issue that was from House Bill 3125 from last session. It was the food processing bill. And this clarifies the definition around how cost is measured, how DOR is to implement the exemption. So that's 30 or LC 178. LC 179 is the vehicle for you to look at any cleanup language that you need around the tax credits. If you look at the relating clause, it's relating to tax credits. Right now, there are four provisions in there. One is around the rural medical changes you made in 15. This removes the language in highway miles and just goes back to distance. The second one is around IDA contributions, clarifies how those are done. The kicker to the contributions to the state school fund, remember this was an issue Department of Revenue talked with you about, this puts that in statute. And there's also some technical language around the alternative energy devices. So those are the four pieces that are in the now. As you know, I'm sure, as we look through credits, if we come across some other kinds of things that need clarification around the credits, this would be the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. And the hope there is that there are, my hope is that there are technical changes, not adding more credits.
Not policy changes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
I move LC 177 dated 12/28/15, LC 178 dated 12/21/15, and LC 179 dated 1/11/16 be adopted to committee bills, and I will speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves LC 177, LC 178, and LC 179.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, introduction of LC measures does not complementate support or opposition, simply brings them into play so that we can study them in the future and hopefully take action that is revenue neutral. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments? Seeing none. Motion's adopted. Those measures will be introduced for the February session.
Taking a question before we go on, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Am I unfortunately correct that since this is a 179, when something like that comes forward, is there going to be a joint committee on tax credits again during the short session to address these issues?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, I was just checking. Thank you.
All right, we have three issues to discuss in an informational meeting, school formula, tax burden, and gross receipts. We're going to do them slightly out of order to accommodate Senator Riley's schedule. So we're going to start with economic and distribution impacts of a broad gross receipts tax, if that's okay with everyone. A presentation from the Legislative Revenue Office. So let's begin with that.
Thank you.
the screen.
So you need to minimize that. There you go.
This is the simplified version, Doc.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue, and Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue, we have been working on the OTIM update that we provided for the committee in December, and this follows up on some of the work from that report, as you recall. We do have some additional discussion around the initial estimates of the tax burden, but I'll get to that next. What we wanted to do, and this is really kind of based on the feedback we'd gotten from you, is we know there's a lot of interest, obviously, in a gross receipts tax. In our presentation to you in December, we had gone through and looked at a series of combination packages. What we have done here is look at, in isolation, a broad gross receipts tax and run it through our OTIM model, what we've done is go through and provide you with a lot more detailed output than we have before. Rather than give you the simple summary sheet, walk through some of the implications that come about from the model, and at least how we interpret those implications, the results of the model. What we did was impose a gross receipts tax across the board. So we imposed it on all sectors. It's roughly 0.4%. It's actually a little bit less than that, about 0.39, but it remember the Ohio cat was 0.26, so it's about half again larger than the Ohio cat in percentage terms. What we want to do is just to scale it to $1 billion in terms of its static estimate. I'll go through with you kind of the difference between the static estimates and what the real estimates would be and a revenue impact, putting it in a time frame and incorporating some of the dynamic effects. But this first chart, what it does is show you the output, the input that we put into it's the $1 billion spread across all sectors. And when the model has been run, it calculates the dynamic feedback, so the impact on revenue as a result of the change in economic activity. And what this says is that you would get, again in 2017 terms, instead of $1 billion, as you would get in a static estimate, you'd get $923 million. So, and I'll put that again in a timing phrase so you see what that would mean in the reality of a revenue impact statement. But if you do the calculations on that, it's a 7.7% feedback. And that's the range that we are typically in with our OTIM estimates. Actually, the updated version, I think, is slightly less responsive than our earlier version, but it's typically been in the range of 2 or 3% up to 15% in terms of what that feedback would be. Now, of course, the decisions about where the revenue would go would obviously be a part of any proposal. This, we've just dumped everything in the general fund. The general fund, of course, would have an impact because it would not get as much income tax collections as it would in the current law forecast because of the negative feedback. So instead of getting $1 billion, it'd be 977.
Excuse me, Paul, could we get some working definitions from you? First of all, we're talking about 1 year here.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And on dynamic feedback, could you give us a brief summary of what we're talking about through the modeling that you've done?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The way the model works, I mean, we refer to it as a dynamic impact, but technically, this is an example of comparative static analysis. We take a point in time, we have an equilibrium point in time based on current law, based on hard data, and then we say, okay, we're going to change one of the policy parameters. We let the model run through what those responses are in terms of labor markets, capital markets, and so forth, and then we have a new result. Well, that's the new equilibrium or the comparative static. So, but I'll talk about the specifics on the timing here in a minute and how we would apply this actually to a revenue impact estimate. But here you can see that the impact, the secondary impact, the feedback impacts, a lot of them would be on other funds revenue, that, for example, revenue associated with motor fuel, associated with weight mile, with various other types of activity around fees, for example, and a number of them are population-based. And you'll see that one of the things that happens in this kind of proposal, you change the population estimate, which drives a lot of these other fund revenues. Local revenue is also affected primarily through the property tax. So if you add up those three effects, 23 less on the general fund, 23 on the other fund, 31 on the local revenue, you get to $77 million. So that's the sum of that feedback from the revenue side. Now here's the dynamic part as we try to put it into a time frame. This is our expectation is that if you are to impose this tax in 2017, it would take roughly a five-year period to feel that full dynamic impact. So, of course, during that five-year period, something like a gross receipts tax that's based on general economic activity would be growing. So we've built in a growth factor here, and you can see that the static estimate would grow from about a billion up to about $1.15 billion over the five-year period. So about a 3% growth rate over time, and that's what we're assuming. So in order to build in these feedback effects into a revenue impact statement, what we do is we assume that it comes in a 5, 20% cumulative increments. So first year, 20% of the impact, second year, 40%, fifth year, 100%. And then you're at this new equilibrium with the built-in feedback into your estimates. So that's how we would build it in. We would take the current law forecast, whatever's coming from DAS, and then we would adjust that for our estimate of revenue, which would build in the feedback. So that's how we'll build in the time frame. Now, the time frame is an approximation, of course. We think that it's longer, takes longer during recessions, because there's less economic activity, there's less investment decisions going on, and probably less time during a period of rapid growth when you're near capacity. So that's the revenue piece of this. Now, if you look at overall economic effects, state economic effects, this is a summary table of what the model has produced. These are 2017 numbers in terms of dollars, but they're after the full adjustment. So again, it's just comparative static, comparing one point with the next. You can see that nominal personal income, by nominal personal income, I mean personal income not adjusted for changes in the price level, ends up being $344 million less. Nominal personal income in the economy is about $200 billion. So it comes out to about 0.2% in terms of a reduction in nominal personal income. Household income goes down considerably more. And the reason is nominal personal income includes the public sector. I mean, it's the entire economy. Household income is what we call disposable income. It's gross income plus transfer payments from the government minus taxes to the government. So with a new $1 billion tax, you've reduced household income. That's what's going to the public sector.
And how is it that you're reducing the income? Because they're paying more because there's fewer jobs. How do you get to those negatives?
The household income, well, you can see the primary way that it's impacted is through the price level. In fact, if you look at these two numbers, you can see, if you look at the nominal personal income and the real per capita income, that tells the story. Nominal personal income is down about 0.18%, but what's down by the same amount is population. So what we're saying is you end up with a smaller population, smaller economy as a result of this policy change. It doesn't necessarily mean people move out. It means that your migration is slightly less, or your net migration is slightly less.
They'll be less likely to be offered jobs, or they won't be drawn to jobs here, and so they won't come here.
That's exactly right, yes. So that's where you get that marginal change in the economy. So you're not going to see a bunch of people leave the state necessarily, but what you'll see is a slower rate of migration over time. And that's normally the way economies respond. Because what you're doing when you change the prices, you start to change the price signals in the system. so-and-so, and that's how it's responding. Now, if you look at the nominal income and population, they offset. So what that means is, in terms of dollars and cents nominal income, on a per capita basis, it's about the same. But if you look at real per capita income, which adjusts for inflation, the reduction in real per capita income is $177. The percentage decline is almost exactly equal to the percentage increase in the price level.
Right. Senator Berkshire, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Warner, we all know that we have the baby boomers are really starting to move into retirement over the next couple decades. Because of that, would that affect people making the decision to move into Oregon? Because Oregon already is not friendly to retirement compared to other states. Would this add to that unfriendliness?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bettinger, the overall migration patterns are built into the baseline forecast. So what we would assume would happen here is that the baseline, the forecast that we're getting from across the street that builds in those estimates would be adjusted for this change. I wouldn't go so far as to say this would disproportionately affect baby boomer retirements. Oregon has, what you're doing, in effect, you're raising the price level, and that may drive out some people that would have come here otherwise over time. But in general, it's not aimed directly at senior income, for example. For example, if you were to make a constitutional amendment and include Social Security and income taxes, that would be a lot more direct kind of change, and we would expect a bigger impact there.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Paul, on the chart that's right here, this is 0.4%, or I will take your word, there's 3.992789 or whatever, right, instead of 4%. If it was six times larger that and like 2.4%, would you just simply multiply these numbers by six? Trick question. You know what I'm talking about.
Well,
theoretically.
Mr. Vice Chair, I think there's two things there. One is, do these variables move together? They're obviously related. I don't think they would move together proportionally exactly the amount. So you get some different changes in population, for example, than you may get in the price level and have more of a mix of real and nominal changes. But the other issue that you run into is, these kinds of models, they rely on certain linearities. That, there's a zone there where you can make linear changes in the model. And there's always a question, when do you get outside that linearity, when things get so bad that you really start to see some bigger effects? And, we see that in the macroeconomy. When does a recession become a deep recession? We've seen that in the economy in 08 and 09, when you start to drop off that cliff. And it's not just a linear drop. It's kind of you start to drop. So you could change your environment, your economic environment in your state at some point where you get a discrete drop if it becomes bad enough or perceived as bad enough. But what we're working with here, we're basing things on these kind of linear relationships that are really the basis for the model. So we're not real good at picking up those kind of discontinuities.
Thank you, Mr. Question.
Senator Edwards.
Is this chart 2022 from the 2017 baseline?
Senator, it's the five-year change, but just to try to keep things a little less complicated, we put everything in $17. Okay. So in other words, we didn't blow things up. So just so we keep them on an even keel with the same dollar. But it is what the total effect would be, and we think that'll take about 5 years for that to happen. So, but what we're saying here is that we don't think that the population's going to go down 8,000. Compared to 2017, it's going to go 8,000 compared to what it was forecast to be in 2022. Mm-hmm. So the next thing that we looked at was some specific employment numbers, and of course, what happens when you pull $1 billion out of the private sector and put it in the public sector, you're going to create more public sector jobs. And to be honest with you, we're not real sophisticated on how we treat public expenditures. They're built into the model as either education or non-education, so they're general in scope. We don't distinguish between investing in transportation or investing in infrastructure, for example, versus something else. So what that means is what we're picking up on the government side is predominantly demand effects. And if you take $1 billion out of the economy, it's not flushed down the toilet. It's provided by the public sector, and the public sector spends it. And so the model allocates that to all the sectors that the public sector buys from. And that's where you get this increase in jobs of 6,000 in the public sector, but you get a decrease in jobs in the private sector of 15,000. So you have a net decrease of 9,000 after all changes have been made.
How about applying Senator Boquist's question to this set of facts? Is it, can you extrapolate five times, six times on this?
Well, that's again, Mr. Chair. I think there is a point you would come. Would a $5 billion tax be five times $1 billion? I would be hesitant to say that. In reality, the model will probably show something close to that. But the model's based on those linearities, that at some point, you know, that it becomes less reliable. And that's true of any kind of change that you're trying to model. You know, consumers may change a certain amount to a 5% change in price. Are they going to change, five times more to a 25%? Well, it could be they could respond a lot more. So it's not necessarily linear. And that would apply to this, too. We would be comfortable over a range, but at some point you get outside the range. If you look at this just in terms of dollars here and the overall public sector, it would be about a 10% increase in state revenue, state tax revenue, and about a 5% increase in overall SALT or state and local tax revenue.
Senator Boquist, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a follow-up to my question the chair asked, which was my question before, you set a range here. So if this is, hypothetically raising a billion here, and it was raised $5 billion, which is five times larger, right? What is the range of the other end? So as example, five times the revenue, private sector job would be 75,000 lost, with a gain, of course, of the public sector jobs on the opposite side. What is the range of error in that side, do you think? I think you heard you said 25% range.
Mm-hmm.
You were comfortable with.
Well, one thing to keep in mind about these revenue numbers, they're annual. So we're talking about $1 billion annually.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think they would be representative certainly within, say a doubling either way of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, that's a hard thing to perceive because we don't have empirical evidence on these kinds of changes. We've never imposed $1 billion gross receipts tax in Oregon, or any state really that we know of
might
that
be the first,
done
huh?
It in isolation.
Another Oregon first.
So we're looking at these simulations, and they are
based on. It's 2.5 billion anyway, not a billion, so it'll be a big one for you.
Senator Butcher.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So we got loss of private sector jobs, we got addition to public sector jobs. What's the average, in today's dollars, the average income in the private sector compared to the average income in the public sector? Do we have that number?
Well, Senator, I'm thinking, trying to
with benefits.
What we've built into the model would be, I think it's a 50,000 on the public and about 40 on the private.
Right.
Does that include the benefits on the public side?
That would be, I believe that's just wage and salary. We have another component in the model that's called other labor income, which includes benefits.
So just kind of a guess, what if we added benefits to the public sector side, what would we be looking at?
For the we'd probably be looking at another 20% or so.
Which would?
Be 60.
60.
Yeah. And of course, there's a lot of variation there. I mean, obviously.
Sure, I'm just trying to look at it.
Mm-hmm. But we do have those. I can tell you what's in the model, and I'll send an email to everybody, tell you exactly, because we have detailed wage sectors in the model. And part of what's going on here is that on average, the public sector does pay more. So you do have that effect, where you've got you got the job gains here, which can have bigger effect because they have a higher total income.
I guess, you know, when we look at these numbers, Dr. Warner, we got to be careful because a lot of times in the public sector, we'll pay more, but we don't have the benefits because that's what the employee wants. They would rather have the money and do their own thing. We're in the public sector, we have a tendency to pay more benefits. So, you know, we got to make sure we're talking apples and apples when we talk about these two wages.
You're exactly right, Senator. And I think it is important to keep in mind that this, it doesn't matter how many equations you put into a model or how sophisticated you make it, it's going to be a gross simplification.
Sure.
So we're trying to look at a simulation that gives you some sense of magnitude and direction, but a lot of the subtleties are, you know, are just not built in.
And Senator Edwards, and to clarify, policy outcomes don't. I mean, that's not factored in. I mean, we may have fewer manufacturing jobs, but more teachers, and that, like, what the long term, 10-year, the 20-year outcome of that. That's not a part of that. This is just jobs and income.
Mr. Chair and Senator years. Edwards, that is really one of the things that I want to emphasize when you kind of stand back and look at this at the end is, as I said, one of the positives I think about this kind of model is it does pick up that demand side effect, this side here where, yeah, you got 6,000 more people working. It doesn't just float away and leave the state. So that demand side is captured. What it doesn't capture is what Senator Edwards is talking about, that if the state makes wise investments in its education system, leads to a greater, more productive labor force, which in turn attracts investment into the state where people want to make investments and pay higher wages. Those kind of things are not, the supply side is not built in. We have that structure in the model. We have that parameter that we basically turn off in this analysis. And the reason why we do that is because we just don't have any, well, two reasons. We don't have good evidence of what the parameter should be. You know, what should we plug in? And we can plug in a number, sure, and we could look at a range, and we've done that. And the second thing is we think that the timing of those benefits on the public sector side are a lot different than this five-year period. So that's back to what you're saying. If you invest in early childhood education and the inmate population goes down 20 years from now, that's going to be outside the range of this time frame, but still something you need to consider and think about as a policymaker. Mm-hmm. So the other thing we wanted to show you, and this is a collapsing of a number of sectors. So we have 80 sectors in the model, so we can get into some detail. And you can see kind of how this is distributed in terms of its impact. It's pretty much across the board. But the proportions are a little different. You can see where the biggest numbers are. And not surprisingly, the biggest employment difference would be in retail trade, about 3,400. You'd have about a 2,200 reduction in manufacturing. Both manufacturing and ag and natural resources do have, particularly some manufacturing sectors, have a lot of intermediate purchases. And that's where a gross receipts tax comes in. Remember, it's based on that. It's a transaction. If you buy an input from another company, that's subject to the gross receipts tax. And then you turn around and sell it to another company, then it's going to be paid again. So that's where gross receipts, and that's why that base is so broad and why you get a large amount of revenue for a low rate. But you can see that every sector has a negative, and the biggest ones are the biggest sector. Healthcare is another one. The only one that we found was positive, and we're not quite sure why, is information. But what that's telling us, the model says public sector buys a lot of services from the information sector, which is a small sector, as you can see.
Well, my computer's not working, so I need to buy more.
So that gives you the raw numbers. But if you look at kind of proportionally, you can also see kind of how the model's working. The private sector employment, the 15,000, is down 0.68%. So about 2/3%. Ag and natural resources, because it has a lot of intermediate purchases within it, is down more percentage-wise. Manufacturing as well. Arts and entertainment, retail, trade, healthcare are all more than proportionally affected. These are largely from the consumer side, because this gets to be basically a tax on consumption.
Senator Riley. And again, this is not the overall private sector down 0.6% is not immediate, and it isn't necessarily even a loss of jobs. It's 6%, 0.6% less than what's projected to be in 5 years.
Exactly. And Senator, I'll show you a chart that does just that. So you get that perspective, but that's exactly right. So the sectors that are not affected as much, you can see, and again, this gives you some idea of how the model will work with other proposals around a gross receipts tax. And for example, utilities are less affected. They have a lot of ability to pass prices on. Information services, we said, have purchases from the public sector. But you can see how those different sectors are impacted. So you do have some spreading across it. Now, as we start to look at, as we have, IP28, these sectors are all going to be affected differently. What we have here with our gross receipts tax, we've slapped a 0.4% tax on all transactions in these sectors. Every time they make a transaction with another sector. With IP28, that will be different, the impact on those different sectors, because the proportion of sales in those sectors will vary depending on how many are represented by C corporations with more than $25 million in sales. So what we're trying to do and what Chris is working diligently on is to figure out what those proportions would be by sector. And we can do that by looking at the tax return.
Senator Edwards.
So key clarification, this does not have the 25, this is just broad-based.
Yes. Everyone is paying
not the 25 million in sales threshold.
That's exactly right, Senator. And you know, that's where the work for us comes in, because you know, the work for us is the input. And so it's easy for us to input a uniform tax, but something like this, we have to go through and go through the tax returns, and we're not going to precisely know what that is for a variety of reasons, but at least we'll get an approximation that'll make a lot more sense than just assuming across the board. Give us a better idea what those proportions will look like. But then it would, you know, work through these sectors based on what we inputted plus these secondary effects. So now this is back, this is to Senator Riley's comment. If you look at the gross receipts tax on employment projections, you know, if you take the December forecast, these are not quite exactly the same measures of employment, but your current law baseline December forecast has employment growing by about 120,000 over a five-year period. So they're pretty optimistic about growth and employment in the economy. So you put this 9,000 on that overall, and that would include the public sector. It comes out you can see the difference there. So the 2 points here, the difference would be right in here would be 9,000 after 5 years.
That makes it look a lot different than that other chart.
Yes. So, and that's, again, why, you know, to put that kind of perspective is, you know, we're looking at a big economy. So the other thing that we looked at was the effect on the distribution of the tax burden. And I do have, I've kind of gone things a little differently than we thought, but I also have some material I wanted to go through with you about the baseline distribution of the tax burden. I'll get to that in a minute. You can see that this is taking that baseline and looking at how the new equilibrium would compare after the response to the tax change. And you can see that households are down in all the sectors. Again, this is, you know, your population's down about 8,000, so your households are down about 3,200. So you can do that arithmetic on that relationship. But you notice, one thing to notice about these percentage declines, one thing, and I've got another chart on this, but these are not the same size. And we do that because the high-income folks are fewer households, because we kind of want to distribute it based on who's paying the income tax. So if you look at the percentage change, notice that for high-income individuals, the percentage change is greater, particularly for the greater than 205,000. And that's directly due to one of the inner workings of the model. We have mobility parameters for all the different income groups, and the high income groups have the highest mobility parameter. They have the resources to respond. They move more from different states, so it may not be people moving from Oregon, but it may mean we're getting a smaller proportion of that group coming in. And so that's based on pretty solid empirical evidence that higher income individuals have higher mobility. Now, that shows up if you look at the tax burden. You can see all of the, this is the $799 million distributed among the average household for each of these groups. And you can see all of them have a reduction, and the reduction grows with income. So that makes some sense. But it's a little misleading because you think, well, is that a progressive allocation? And the answer is no. This tax, because it's a consumption tax, reduces the progressivity in the system. And you can see that because the lowest group has the second lowest group has a decline of 0.3%. The highest income group has a decline percentage terms of about half of that.
Because they don't buy as much per dollar. They don't spend as many a bigger percentage of their dollars on stuff.
That's exactly right, Senator. Their consumption ratio to income is less. Mm-hmm. And they buy things like buy more out-of-state things and travel and all those kind of things. But so their purchase of in-state taxable products would be less. Mm-hmm. So, and that's where, and I'll go back to the other presentation. You can see how we think this is distributed now in more detail. But and this would be a result we would expect. So, so these are the conclusions that we would draw from this. First of all, that the revenue feedback we think is negative, but relatively small. And you know, you get kind of the reverse when you have a tax reduction. You get a positive feedback in many cases, but it's usually small relative to the static impact. The personal income reductions that you saw in the model are offset by reduced population. So in other words, people move out of the state, that's what causes income to go down. What causes real per capita or inflation adjusted per capita income to go down, we saw $177, is higher price level. So the price level's gone up and that gets shifted into higher prices. And, of course, there would be some differences depending on what your consumption patterns are, because we saw some sectors are affected more than others. Private sector employment loss more than offsets the public sector increase, but the employment losses overall are small relative to the totals. And the private sector employment loss is spread broadly across all sectors, and they occur in those sectors that have the most transactions, and those that tend to be service sectors, retail trade, that where you have domestic consumption, where you're seeing the effect on consumers. You're at the standpoint of a producer, you're much more able to raise your prices if you're selling your product in Oregon, because all your other domestic competitors are affected by this tax. If you're an exporter, you don't have that price power. You're basically a price taker because your competitors have not been affected by this tax policy change. So that's why we always try to make a real distinction between domestic and export. The exporters are much more likely to have the output losses, which would lead to employment losses. And finally, the size of the tax burden increases with income, but at a lower proportional rate, meaning there is a decrease in the amount of progressivity in the system. So, again, not great, and you'll see, I'll show in the next presentation, that our system is largely proportional and is really one of the most, one of the least regressive in the country because of our tax mix, because we don't have a consumption tax. So this would move us, and something we've talked about before, this would move us more to like other states because we'd have a consumption tax built in.
not great, but in public finance, when you talk about taxes, it's kind of pick your poison, isn't it? And so any tax where you're going to raise $1 billion more a year than you are now is going to have some negative feedback. Is that true?
I think that's pretty much true, Mr. Chair. And you know, I mean, it makes sense when you look at kind of the analysis. And really, I mean, if you think about what's the core reason to raise taxes? Well, the core reason to raise taxes is to purchase more public services. And it, you really, the, you know, you get to the next step in this process is, okay, well, what are you going to do with that money? And how are you going to spend it? And what that what effect is that going to have on the economy? This is just kind of a, you know, an amorphous expenditure that shows gives you some idea what might happen. But if you get into details, you know, if you would go into a ways and means process and look at, okay, we're going to spend X on education, X on transportation, then you could start to look at some of, you know, fuller analysis of what those impacts might be. But I will warn you that, I mean, on this tax stuff, we're way ahead of where they are in the expenditure stuff in terms of looking at the secondary impacts. It's just... There's not. It's very difficult to do, and you don't see a lot of it in the literature. It's very complicated.
On ways and means.
Can I talk about one of those ways and means people? Oh, I can't do that. That's disparaging. Huh?
So. Okay, I don't do that at all. So we probably spent more time on the gross receipts tax than any other tax in this committee over the last year or so, and I have a sense that we're not done studying it for this year. So. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think, as I said, we're continuing to work on IP 28, and we hope to have some updates for you in the session and give you, you know, give the committee an update of where we're at. But this kind of gives you an idea of what the end and what the outputs will be. And you'll see the numbers will change, but this you'll be able to see how the different sectors we have, we think they'll be affected, how we think it'll affect the distribution of the tax burden, how it will affect overall employment and income and so forth. So those are the kind of results you should have, and we'll just try to refine those to better reflect what the proposal actually is.
Senator Bilquist.
And I think what I hear you telling us is that when you move from apples where we are now to oranges, it's though it's more difficult, it's going to be more narrower. It may have... There'd be a smaller range of businesses involved, smaller range of employment involved, and two or three of your bullets there may be adversely affected in terms of, since there's going to be a narrower range of this group, it's going to be, it's not broad-based.
Right.
It is gross, but it's gross on a very narrow group of people.
Yes, that's exactly right, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. But what it does, you know, the magnitude, of course, is bigger.
Right.
So that will push those numbers up. But it will have a different initial effect on those individual sectors rather than an across-the-board same effect and then go from there. So I think that, you know, that's where we'll have to do our value added in terms of the inputting of the analysis.
Senator Edwards?
So with a narrower or smaller group of affected businesses, does that lower your confidence with how... Does that lower your confidence in the output of the model? Or does it make it less predictable? Like, you're taking your best shot at it, but you don't.
Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, that is something we've talked a lot about, is the fact that, you know, we have a pretty standard, what's called neoclassical model here that it's based on. You know, we based on competitive markets. Response of, you know, a large number of firms participating in those markets. It's Oregon firms, and you have the rest of the world. So when you get in those kind of large numbers, you have more confidence because there's kind of certain behavioral rules that make sense. When you're dealing with a few large corporations, oligopolists that have market power, then it becomes less predictable. Because they have more options, and how does a global corporation respond to a tax policy change in a, let's face it, not a big market, which Oregon is, how would they change? Well, they've got a lot of options, and it's not just a kind of a predictable response you would see in a competitive market. So we are concerned about how that might increase uncertainty. So, I mean, it's just like when you have a labor union negotiating wages with a large firm. Mm-hmm. Or with the auto industry, with the United Auto Workers, you know, it's hard to model what that price result will be because it depends on the negotiation and other factors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you for that. Let's go back to the top of the list and move it to local school formulas and bring in day.
Okay, Mr. Chair, do the tax distribution?
Yeah, do there. Okay, all right. That
might
makes
be
sense.
Might worry a little easier.
Yes.
Distribution of Oregon's local tax burden.
So, again, this, we did talk some about this issue when we presented to the Joint Committee in December, but I didn't feel like we kind of got to some of the key issues for you to kind of think about with this. And the idea behind looking and revisiting this base distribution is so that when we show you these changes, you'll have an idea what we're changing from, which I think makes could be important, in your decisions. So, and we do have a unique structure, as we've said. We had last built in a base distribution in 2001, so we hadn't changed that since 2001. So it took a lot of work because we had to go back through and get Department of Revenue tax returns, match those with property tax returns. But this is the result of doing that. And if you look at as I mentioned when we were looking at the distribution, the number of households in each of these groups is different. So you can see the biggest number is in this 69 to 103 group. Now, if you ask anybody, they all consider themselves middle income, but you can see kind of how it is actually distributed.
Some are more middle ground.
So, but you also notice that the 205,000 group, even though they're the smallest group of about 100,000, they're also, of course, have the most in terms of, particularly on the income tax, of revenues. This is what the overall effective tax rate we think is. This is based on both, this is the total taxes paid, and it's after the effects of the model. So in other words, it picks up whatever shifting there is, or what we've tried to pick up. And just to make it clear what we're looking at here, this is 8.36% is the average. This is Oregon state and local taxes. It's not federal taxes. It's not Alaska severance taxes or taxes of any other state that might be shifted to Oregon. And if you ever looked at the Tax Foundation stuff, they do try to include that. Tax importing and exporting, and they consistently have Oregon as a net importer of taxes relative to what we export. And that just has to do with our industry mix. Alaska is a major exporter because they impose taxes on oil and gas, and then that gets built into the price for consumers. But this is Oregon only. It excludes taxes paid by Oregonians or taxes in Oregon that are exported. And we do assume a portion of the corporate income tax is exported to owners of capital.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bocas.
This tax burden include property tax?
Yes. This includes all taxes. All taxes in Oregon.
Hire you as an accountant. Can you do my taxes?
I don't do taxes. Mr. Vice Chair, I'm an economist, not an accountant.
He has a personality.
Right, right.
I don't do anything less than $1 million. Here's how it's broken down by the major taxes. So if you look on this, you can see you've got this regressive piece as the lowest income groups are paying a high effective tax rate. And that drops off suddenly. And then it becomes essentially proportional until you get to the end where you've got a progressive tail. So you almost have this kind of bowl shape in terms of the distribution. And that's, we had something similar to that in the last time we did
a
this.
Really shallow bowl.
Shallow bowl, largely flat. There it is, largely flat.
Yeah.
Yes. But you can see that the components are widely different in their impact. That regressive tail is really driven by the property tax.
Mm-hmm.
And the property tax, though, I mean, has gotten, I think, some bad publicity over the years as being a regressive tax. There is a regressive element to it. It comes from the residential piece. And a lot of it is age-driven. This is the elderly, seniors that have low income, low current income, but own their own houses. So they're paying that property tax. And then as you move into the middle ranges, in a very wide range, from 20,000 up to over 100,000, it's pretty much proportional, the residential is. So the property tax is largely proportional, and then it has another regressive tail as you get to the very high income, and residential property just becomes a smaller proportion of their assets.
Paul, how do you factor in renters?
Renters are built in through, they come in through the business property tax. So the model shifts a portion of that onto consumers and a portion of it onto owners of rental property. And that, the way that's done is through the price of rental property. So you've got property owners that are the real estate sector supplying to these rental services, housing services to this group, and they're paying rent for it. So when you impose a property tax, it should raise that price to some extent. And then you can see the regressive tail here on the non-residential, but that's really residential because it picks up the property, the owners. And then you can see it starts to turn more progressive out here because this is business property out here.
Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why do we have the lowest income paying the highest property taxes?
The lowest income pays the highest property taxes predominantly because you have a lot of individuals who own property, primarily the seniors, who have low current income. They're living on Social Security or something like that, but they purchased their homes in the past. So their homes may be paid for so that they, you know, the distinction is this: the property tax is a measure of, is a tax on wealth. It's not a tax on income, a tax on wealth. So you may have somebody that has a higher lifetime income, therefore more wealth, and the property tax is based on that, and then you divide it by their current income, which is a lot lower, it comes out looking regressive.
So then that does, it is very consistent when I hear constituents in my district saying that if property taxes go up anymore because I have a fixed income, I'm going to have to move out of my house.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's it. So, and you can, Senator, you can show them this graph and say that's...
Got it. So that's
why it's a significant issue. And that's why, of course, you've had, really, I mean, we've been one of the states that's been less involved in a lot of property tax relief programs because we had these big mega property tax limitations. We used to be a lot more involved in that with the HARP program, for example, in the 80s. Now we've had essentially the senior property tax deferral is the only program really standing. But that's an issue that would be part of your discussion if you were to pursue the homestead exemption. Because this would reduce this more. The other element that comes in here that always kind of makes us wonder, because it's a difficult thing for us to deal with, you have a group of people in this low-income group that have property, that have capital gains, even a lot of them have capital losses. So they may have a negative on their tax returns. So we put them in this group. We zero them out. We don't put them in as a negative. We put them in as a zero. But they own property. They have Schedule C, you know, their business operating out of their garage. They have some property associated with that. So that's another piece of that, too. It's kind of the smaller businesses, real small businesses, that may be having a loss, and so they have current low income, and then they may be paying some property tax based on that property. So now the other piece of this, of course, what drives it is the personal income tax. And you can see that you've got this progressive element that comes up, and we saw a little bit of that when you looked at the kicker distribution. A lot of this comes in this area comes from the earned income tax credit and the working family credit, or previously the working family credit. And you can see then as we get up toward the 9% marginal rate, then it largely flattens out. So it's almost proportional in this, which is a pretty large block of space from 48,000 to 200,000. And then the 200 and above, you got a progressive tail on it. And that's the biggest change we've seen from the last time we did this, because you had some significant policy changes. You've added an additional marginal bracket of 9.9%. You've phased out the federal tax subtraction, and you've also zeroed out the personal exemption credit for high-income individuals. So that's all had the effect of pushing this line up. So, and then the last chart I have is on the distribution of the tax burden for Oregon's minor taxes. And you can see we've got a regressive tail here. I think this is picking up some of the elements around. One of the things that gets caught in this other taxes is the provider tax, which is also on gross receipts. And I think this is picking up some of that. Again, you're not looking at the benefits side because that tax is just used for health care benefits. Not one-to-one, but still pretty close. But some of the other excise taxes. Now, when we say alcohol, of course, in Oregon, we mean just beer and wine. We're not including spirits. And then you can see alcohol tobacco. You've heard this a lot over the years, that this is a regressive tax. It falls with income. And then the fuel tax, the gas tax, is, of course, also. So when you look at those kinds of raising those taxes, you will reduce the progressivity in the system.
Question. Senator Porter.
Alcohol and tobacco. Alcohol is just wine and beer, not spirits. And why is that,
Senator? Yes, because the way that this is built on census data, and census data considers OLCC to be a government enterprise. So the gross revenue that comes into OLCC is revenue from a government enterprise, not a tax. And then of course they have expenses, and the difference is the markup, and that's where we get the distribution of the general fund. So, but something like the marijuana tax, now that will show up as an excise tax.
Because that would be in other taxes then.
That would be in other taxes, but we don't have it in there yet. We don't have any data on that.
Might be a lot.
So,
if Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Edwards.
If somebody from Oregon wins the Powerball, will it throw all this off? I just remembered this. I haven't played for like 10 years, but I might buy a ticket.
Senator, we'd have to redo the model. Yeah.
I know. It's tonight, I think.
We'd have to update the model again.
Okay.
Update it.
Yes.
Well, let's not get the tax savings, because I understand the Chinese are buying them by internet. So what if it's an Oregon business selling internet lottery tickets from here? Do we have a tax haven then?
Yes. Or is it an Oregon saying?
Right.
So the bottom line here is that we have a largely proportional system, and that is unique among the states. It's, studies have put us somewhere always within the top 10 in terms of least regressivity, and that's because of the mix. So if you make some substantial changes away from that, then, you can think about what those implications are as you mix those taxes. It'll have an impact on that distribution. So that's all we have, Mr. Chair.
All right.
We're not going to be tested on this, are we?
And now we get to day.
Mm-hmm.
Local schools.
Wait, Mr. Chair, can I ask one
non-lottery question? Yes.
Non-lottery. If you were to take out, if you go all the way back to the very first, the bowl slide.
Shallow bowl slide.
Yeah.
That one.
Yeah. So, how does our state compare to other states in how the tax burden is distributed? I mean, do we tend to be more flat-ish or more? I mean, just if you were to take out outliers, I mean, is this really typical?
Mm-hmm. Least regressive.
Senator, the answer is we're not typical. If you look at, in general, the more reliant a system is on consumption taxes, the more regressive it is. Yeah. Of course, we're zero. We have least reliance of anybody. So, so if you compare Washington, for example, Washington's almost just a straight line down.
Mm.
And then they've done a lot of studies. Maybe I'll dig up one of those and bring it in so you can kind of see. But they've done a lot of studies on their progressivity, and it's just progressive straight across, because as that income goes up, the percentage that's subject to tax through the Washington retail sales tax and the gross receipts tax just declines. So it's regressive. If you think about the South, the southern states tend to have very highly dependent on sales taxes, and a lot of them have tax food, which of course adds another element of regressivity to it. I mean, what you include in the base. So, you know, there's only five states that don't have a sales tax. So that in and of itself tends to make us more progressive. And I've seen some studies. I know Fred Thompson at Willamette has done some analysis comparing the states, and I'll get that and send it to everybody and take a look and see how he ranks them. But he has Oregon as one of the least regressive. And that's pretty typical.
However, Senator Edwards, Dr. Warner and I and others designed a sales tax proposal in 2013 that was with that and with other changes to the tax code, continued to make Oregon's tax code as progressive as it is now through credits and other cuts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and as you recall, Mr. Chair, one of the things we used was, it's kind of a clever thing that Washington had done. They set up a household basis for looking at their sales tax. So they had a little model that we could input into it, and they allowed us to calculate what the difference would be as a result of the sales tax,
yeah,
and the different items, and if you exempted something, what effect would that have, and so forth.
Senator Boquist.
I have a tax but non-tax related question. I'm just curious, coming back from Texas, I was listening to National Public Radio, so I'm going to discount whatever they said right off the bat here. But they had a very interesting statement, and it wasn't surprising to me, but part of it, but they said of the three most indebted per capita states, the government was most indebted. I think California was number one, which is no surprise to any of us here, but Oregon they listed as number three, and I have no idea. It seemed really strange to me. Were they talking about, they might have been talking about the bond level of indebtedness or something, and I just like, okay, we can't borrow money. I don't know how they would.
Per capita.
I don't know how National Public Radio would be saying that Oregon was the third most indebted per capita state government.
Because about bonds.
But the only thing we can do is bonds, I think. But I don't know. It seemed like a really strange comment to me, and I kind of, like I said, I discounted it because it was National Public Radio. But.
Mr. Vice Chair, you know, the only thing I can think of, we do have that Treasury puts out that Debt Advisory Commission report every year, and they just I think they're going to release one here shortly. You can take a look at that, and they do show where we are. One of the things I know that makes a difference in their charts on that is those pension obligation bonds.
Right.
If you include those, you get a different result than if you don't include those. So that's kind of debatable whether they should be or not. And they show that, but we'll make sure you get a copy of that, because that does show those comparisons, and it has all the states in the table and everything.
Okay. Thank you, gents.
We got enough. I know, but I don't.
He gets to check out of the net here, right? His eyes have already glazed over.
He's never going to go. Stay tuned.
We never do anything, so we never find out if this is actually right.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
We never do it.
That's right. That's why I really need a model for IP28, because it might happen. It's tested, right? We didn't have to vote on it, and they tested it, right?
I have a 96% That's pretty
so crazy. If we raise $5 million, it's better to put it all in the PERS. There won't be any job growth there, will it? Your model would be different.
PERS people will spend it, though. If you put it out in the future, it wouldn't be much.
All right. So if you just put it in the budget.
Okay.
That's what they're going to do. So.
Local school formula revenue update with Dave Beck.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office. Here today to give you an update on actually property taxes mostly. So a little bit of background information. Local revenues defined in ORS Chapter 327.011 become part of the formula revenue available for distribution to school districts and ESDs. The 2015 legislature incorporated our local revenue estimate of $3.673 billion for 2 years. The state pledged $7.3 $1.73 billion out of general fund and lottery revenues. The largest components of local revenues for formula are permanent rate-based property taxes of the school districts and ESDs. For 15-17 school years, the local property the property taxes account for 95.4% of total local revenue. Other components of substantial magnitude are the common school fund distribution, about $110 million for 2 years. Revenues from state forests, depending on the estimates, about $50-55 million for 2 years. And of course, timber payments, whose fate depends on federal legislations. So recent development, preliminary data for 15-16 property tax year show 4.9% growth in school district property taxes and 4.4% growth for ESDs. So in numbers, school property taxes, this is imposed, not necessarily collections. So we got to start from here. So totaling $1.658 billion for school districts, and then $117.5 million for ESDs. Now, compare that with our forecast. Last year, we put out 5.0% growth for school districts, and then 4.9% for ESDs. So forecast errors were 2.1 million for school districts and 0.6 million for ESDs. Quite small nonetheless as forecast errors. If you talk to your districts, school districts, a lot of school districts tell you that the revenues are not coming in as expected. That's because about 10 counties show that they had school district property taxes going over the average, above 4.9%. So 26 counties show less than 4.9% growth in property taxes. So you understand when your school districts tell you that, you know, this LRO put out 5% forecast growth forecast, and we're not seeing that. We have the benefit of looking at the statewide data, and we begged the Department of Revenue to put together data as quickly as possible, and they did an excellent job of showing us some preliminary data. Unanticipated revenue in the spring of 2015, continuing payments of timber payments had been reauthorized for 14-15 and 15-16. These monies had not been anticipated and hence not incorporated in 13-15 and 15-17 budget legislations. Estimated revenue for these payments, from these payments, about $26 million for 2 years. At this point, we don't have update on Common School Fund balance. We're going to get it probably in a week or so. Then we'll know the next year's distribution. So we don't have update on Common School Fund distribution at this point. We're putting together, we're collecting information necessary to put out a revised local revenue forecast on February 10th, immediately following the March 2016 state revenue and economic forecast. The last page shows actually school districts and ESDs property tax growth year over year. Actually, they're quite small. But then you'll see a wide range of property tax growth.
There's no rhyme or reason here either.
Depending on what counties you're talking about. My county, Polk County, actually, is registering higher than 4.9 statewide average property tax growth.
Is that because of the assessor?
So. No surprise is good in forecasting business. We have a relatively small forecast error, but out of 1.8 billion, a little over two million difference would be just in terms of magnitudes. Over 2 million is big, but in terms of percentage of forecast error, economy helps.
So generally speaking, you have 10 counties that are above average and 26 that are below average. It appears to be a safe statement to say that more urbanized counties are above growth and above expectations, and more rural counties are below expectations. Looking at places like Grant County's at 1.6%, Curry's at 2.5%, Sherman's at 1.5%.
Look at Moro.
You ever see Moro?
On average, yes.
Moro's the Port of Moro, Arlington. Industrial investments. Those are the data centers are in there.
Sure has. Senator Boquist, actually. If you look at Multnomah County, it registered only 4.4% growth. Mm-hmm. So,
your shot. Bad analogy there.
On the urban?
Multnomah is at 4.4%, but it is.
Wow. So, on average, Senator Boquist, actually, on average, your statement is correct, but there are some exceptions.
Right.
Could I ask Day a question?
Sure.
It doesn't have urban renewal in it, right?
Pardon me?
It does not have urban renewal revenue in it.
No. So it's not at all. Yeah.
So those areas that have, like Portland, that has a large urban renewal district, so that will be going into the urban renewal district rather than going into the overall revenue.
Yes. That would be correct. Yeah.
And then is it allocated later, or is it just go to urban renewal?
Just goes to urban renewal.
Okay, Dave. So thank you.
Pay more of their
Any share. Other questions, Senator Edwards?
No.
Thanks for the update, Dave. Okay. Do you have any other business, Paul?
I don't, Mr. Chair. Just
before the session.
One of the things for you to think about in the committee is that the Senate President has given us the 8 to 10, 5 days a week slot for February, so we can think about how you want to manage that. Probably more than what the committee would need, unless mm-hmm. you get into some major bill. So that's something to think about. Is how you want when you want the committee to actually meet, because they just said we want to give you flexibility. So
let's stick with the unless anybody wants to start earlier, the 8:30 time.
Okay, we can make that permanent. We can post it, and then everybody will know when it starts.
Let's post it that way.
And then, okay. You know, we can talk further if you wanted to not meet on Friday or something like that. So just let me know.
Okay. So. See what I got. First, I got to see what I can get out of her to make that happen.
I don't like to be in early. And Friday, just wing it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. With no other business before us, we will adjourn. Of course, we will adjourn.